From the WisconsinVegetableGardener.com, this is the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Podcast. I'm Joy Baird.
I'm Holly Baird.
Coming up on the program,
we're going to talk all about tomatoes, planting them, growing them, and what you can do for the best success.
Your questions, our answers, and Mike Novak with the Environmental Report will be back.
And we'll have Linda Limomorvista, and she is the Program Director for Central Texas Garden on PBS, and she's got some great information.
All that and more coming up right now.
The Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Podcast is permeating into your ears with your host, Joey Baird.
And it could be the weeds. Some gardeners try to get all the weeds out of their garden. Other gardeners leave them in their garden. It's really a decision that you need to make. There's benefits to both sides of that. It's just something that you need to figure out what you want to do for your garden.
And Holly Baird.
Canning is a science. When you're canning, you want to make sure you follow the directions, follow the recipe, don't cut corners, don't replace things. It's crucial to you, your health, and your family.
They're professional gardeners with full-time jobs, and they're on the air now.
Welcome to the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Podcast, a podcast for the health-conscious organic gardener worldwide. A gardener show for gardeners. I'm your host, Joy Baird. Beside me is my wife, co-host, gardening partner, and best friend,
Holly Baird.
Behind the TWVG microphone here at the WI Garden Media Studios in Southeast Wisconsin, the information that you're going to hear is important and vital to the health and well-being of your garden. You just may have to tweak some of the dates and times you applied for your particular growing area. If you're tuning in for the very first time, thank you. Welcome to the program. If you've been here for every episode, welcome back. This is episode 22. We have a number of podcasts, all 21, on our website, the WisconsinVegetableGardener.com. Underneath the podcast tab, you can see the image, you can see the guests, you can see the information that we cover. We've got guests from all over North America that are gardeners and preppers to help us all learn and be better at gardening and growing our own food. If you're tuning in for the very first time and you have no clue who we are and you just stumbled upon us, welcome. And Holly will tell you a little bit about who we are, what we do, and we'll get into how to grow those tomatoes.
Sure. So we have the podcast and we also have our video series. We put out several videos a week about how to grow food, what to do with the food you grow, reusing items, troubleshooting, all sorts of great information. Then we have our magazines, which come out quarterly, and they're full color digital magazine that you can find online, and it's free of cost to you, and you can download it or you can print it out or you can just read it on our website or on your mobile device. And then we have this podcast.
So with that being said, that's a little bit about us. You can find all of the information that we do and where we speak at if you're in the Southeast Wisconsin area on our website, thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com. If you want to see where we speak at, you can see the Come See Us tab on the top of the page, along with the video series, the podcast, and a bunch of other stuff there. So let's get into how to grow the best tomatoes. And this is something that 89% of all gardeners who garden grow tomatoes. There are certain gardeners out there who don't like tomatoes, so they don't grow them. I guess it's kind of like a rare breed, those people who don't like ice cream. So with that being said, we have an hour presentation that we do, a full solid hour of how to grow the best tomatoes. Clearly, we don't have the time to do that on this program, but we will give you a lot of the information that will help you get to where you need to be in order to have a very successful harvest of tomatoes. You start your tomatoes from seed. We're already past that, so let's bypass that particular portion of it. You got three types of tomatoes. You got heirloom, organic.
Those are seeds.
You got varieties.
Yeah.
Heirloom, organic, and hybrid types of plants that you can purchase from your local home and garden center. And you may have already started these indoors. There are advantages to all three. It's personal preference. Heirloom is the old-fashioned type of seed that have those characteristics that you just don't find on the new varieties. They have some cracking. They have unusual shapes. And Brandywines or heirloom, just to name those. And there's hundreds and hundreds of other varieties that are heirloom. Organic seeds or organic plants are grown in an organic practice. When you see this certified organic, that means that those particular plants were grown by a standard that has been set by the United States Department of Agriculture, to where if the farmer or gardener uses a miracle-based synthetic product on those plants during the process of growing in order to save the seeds for you to buy, or in the process of creating the starts for you to purchase at your local garden center, those plants would be deemed inorganic. Holly, what is hybrid?
Hybrid is when you take two seeds and two plants or seeds, not plants themselves, but seeds, and you make them cross-pollinate so that you get a combined tomato. So say you have a tomato that produces heavy and you have a tomato that is a little bit more drought resistant. You would combine those two seeds to make a tomato.
You'd cross-pollinate them.
Cross-pollinate them.
To get the seed.
To get the seed. And this is not like GMOs or genetically modified. This is just cross-pollination. It's basically like natural science.
The disadvantage is?
The disadvantage is if you save that seed from the original plant that you start, so say you start the seed this year and then you save the seed from this year, next year it's not going to necessarily have the same production or the same traits.
It won't be identical to the parent plant.
It won't be identical. So it'll take, was it 7 years?
About 5 to 7 years based on what I have seen and heard to try to get back to that original plant that you had bought, the original seed that you had purchased in order to get that specific plant with those traits.
So, now, the seed will grow,
right,
but it may not be true to what it was.
If you have a early girl, let's say, which is a red tomato that produces very quickly, which is a hybrid, and you save those seeds and plant them again next year, you may get a red tomato, you may get an orange tomato, whatever the original combination was whenever they produced that seed in the greenhouse or on the farm. So just keep in mind, heirloom organic, you can save the seeds. Hybrid, you could, but it's not recommended. Now, with all that being said, there's three different categories that these fall in. And this is important because it depends on where you're at and what specific purposes or places you are growing these. You have determinate, indeterminate, and semi-determinate types of tomatoes. These are identified on 99.9% of the seed packets, as well as the starts you will get at your local home and garden center. This information is very important because indeterminate varieties grow indefinitely.
Yeah, they grow indefinitely.
They are a vine. So if you have a lot of space and a cage or a trellis or something, indeterminate's the way to go because they will produce all summer long until it's too cold and they will die or you kill them. Determinate
is a bush-type tomato, and that will grow until it's going to produce fruit for, I don't know, 20 days or so to a month, and then it's going to stop. And then it's done. And then there's semi-determinate, which is also the semi-bush tomato. So it's kind of like a vine and a bush. But what it does is it's going to grow, put some fruit on, and then after it gets like that one initial fruiting, it will just slowly put on fruit throughout the season.
If you're growing in containers, a bush variety or a determinate variety would be best because you are limited on space and you can contain it. You can grow bush varieties in the ground, obviously, or raised beds if you have limited amount of space. We had a lot of good questions. We spoke on two separate occasions this past week in Wausau, which is about a three-hour travel north of the WI Garden Media Studios, and then Muskego, which is about a 40-minute trek south of the WI Garden Media Studios, both talking on how to grow the best tomatoes. And the audience was more of a middle to older age audience, but they had tremendously great questions and they were very intense about learning how to do this. One lady had said that she had been trying to grow tomatoes for 20 years.
Yeah, and she had read several books.
And they all taste worse than the store bought. So with the information we provided her, she was very, very thankful. Mm-hmm. And so with that being said, if you're listening to this and you were in one of those classes or one of those talks, a lot of this has already been covered, but you're getting a refresher. So if you're growing indeterminate, determinate, that determines where you're growing it will determine which one you decide to grow. And the type of tomato you're growing is related to what the intentions that you have at the end of the season for those specific tomatoes.
Right.
cherry.
So cherry is, you know, good for salads or whatnot. Then when there's a nice slicing tomato like beefsteak, black creme, brandy wines.
Good
like
canning tomatoes good there.
Good canning tomato, good slicing tomato too. Or mortgage lifter, that's another good one. And then if you want to do like a paste to make like sauce or salsa, then Amish paste, Roma, San Marzano.
The beefsteaks will work as well.
Yeah.
But they don't have as much, but they will, if you're not going to grow the paste tomatoes, a beefsteak, a lot of beefsteaks or brandywines will do the job.
Right. Like if I was going to grow three tomato plants, I would grow like let's say five. I would grow some cherry tomatoes. And then I would grow beefsteak, black creme, brandywine. I think that's it. Wait, hold on.
And with that, you know, you can
use like a Roma.
Don't grow 50 cherry tomato plants with the intentions of going to can tomatoes, because that's a lot of work. Grow beefsteak. Grow large slicing tomatoes if you're going to can stuff. Yeah. So let's talk about planting the tomato, because this is important. Planting the tomato is as important as harvesting.
So first you want to decide where you're going to put it. You want to make sure where you're going to plant your tomatoes. So you want to choose an area that gets the most amount of sunlight. You want to choose something that gets between 8 and 12 hours is best. If it's a little bit less than 8, not the worst thing.
But you could squeeze 6.5 to 7 out of it. Won't produce as prolific as 8 to 12, but it will work.
Then you want to space them 2 feet apart. Or 2 to 3 feet apart. And just make sure that you use tomato cages, stake them, whatever you want to do just to get them off the ground.
Now, what do you put in the hole at the time of planting? Well, that determines what gardener you're talking to. Every gardener in the world who grows tomatoes has their own secret formula that they have either learned or have been passed down from generation to generation. And you best not question that method, because those gardeners will get mad and may punch you, because this is the technique that I've been using for X amount of years, and it's, you know, everybody has their own unique technique on how to plant tomatoes. Some people will put powdered milk in the hole. Some people will put ground up aspirin in the hole. We use
eggshells.
Some people would grind eggshells up to a powder and put in the hole. One of the key things that we have found is magnesium sulfate, which is Epsom salt, greatly reduces the chances of having blossom root rot. That's at the time of harvest, you think you got a beautiful tomato and it's black on the bottom. What is caused by that is a restriction of calcium being picked up by the tomato plant. You may have plenty of calcium in your soil, but because the plant can't get that calcium due to a couple of different reasons, one mainly being inconsistent watering, the soil dries out, the plant needs the calcium, the plant can't pick the calcium up out of the soil because the soil is not moist in order for it to get it into its roots, so it produces fruit, and the fruit is lacking in calcium as the result of the black portion of the bottom of the tomato. So keep your plants watered. Drip irrigation system is very good thing, or water very thoroughly once a week. And then don't water again until the following week. You can add a handful of Epsom salt at the time of planting. And I will be adding Epsom salt about 2 months into the growing cycle as well to make sure there's plenty of magnesium sulfate in the soil. Now, there'll be people who say, you're adding too much salt to the garden. Well, magnesium sulfate is not necessarily salt. And I'm not adding tonnage. I'm simply adding a handful twice a year in different locations to reduce the effect, to allow the plant to be able to pick up the necessary calcium in the soil and prevent root rot or blossom and rot. Again, calcium and magnesium sulfate, which is Epsom salt. Epsom salt is not calcium, but there's something that goes on there that allows the plant to pick up what calcium is in the soil. I don't understand it. I'm not a tomatoologist or a soilologist or analyst. I just know it works for us, and that's what we do. So you can put that in the hole at the time of planting. You can put that on top of where your tomatoes are going to go. One handful at the about a couple weeks before you plant to allow it to dissolve in the soil. At the time of planting, what we will do is dig a hole 6 inches deep or however deep we need to go with the length of stalk of tomato we have. You want to bury 3/4 of the stem into the ground. You put what we do is we put a little bone meal in the bottom, the recommended applicational rate per hole. and then we put about a half inch of soil, a compost or soil, on top of that fertilizer. That way the roots do not come in direct contact immediately with the fertilizer, and it's less of a shock to the plant. Then we put the plant in, we put more, we put an additional amount of fertilizer, like a tomato tone or a combination of fertilizer that we have created with a variety of different types of fertilizer that we have. So you have about a 10-12-10 type of fertilizer. You can use a triple 10, triple 13, triple 18, that's fine. But the plant, there's going to be excess fertilizer left over that the plant's not going to take up, so keep that in mind. You can do it however you want. This is something that each individual gardener needs to do research on to find out what's best for your particular area. So we will plant the tomato and then bury it 3/4 of the stem, leaving a quarter of the stem, the canopy above the soil, because everywhere on the stalk where hair follicles are, or everywhere on the stalk, there's a potential for roots to develop. So you want more roots. A healthier plant has a lot of roots. A lot of roots gives a healthier plant. So by doing that, it'll build good root system. And we mulch and have a barrier between the plant and the soil, because 90% of the problems that your tomato plant will face will be splash up from the soil. That's where you get early blight, the discoloring of leaves going up the stalk, and then by the end of the season you have no leaves and just some stalk and some tomatoes. So one way to combat that is to use...
You can use whole grain cornmeal. And you want to buy the whole grain. You don't want to buy
the yellow kind as well.
Yeah, the yellow whole grain. You don't want to buy like the processed stuff. And what you're going to do is at the time of planting, you're going to take a handful of it and just put it on the base of the plant. This has a beneficial fungi in it called trichoderma. And what happens is there's diseases in your soil, not just your soil and everybody's soil. There's diseases, there's good stuff, there's all sorts of stuff. And what happens is that early blight is in the soil. So when you water your plants, it splashes up on the soil. When the rain falls, it splashes up on the soil. But this helps prevent that.
Yeah, it greatly reduces it. In addition to have that barrier with the mulch of dry grass clippings, leaves, straw, put the cornmeal down at the time of planting on top of the soil, and then put your mulch on top of that, and really put that barrier to keep stuff from splashing up onto your tomato plants. And that will get you a good jump start. You want to cage them to get them off the ground. And that's pretty much what you need to know to get your tomatoes in the ground. If you do see some discoloring of leaves early on the season, you want to snip them off and trim any leaves from the ground level to 6 inches up the stalk. Clean that out. Just leave it just a bare stalk. And any limbs that has the potential of touching the soil, because that's where that splash up can occur, even with mulch. So you really want to get that opened up at the bottom and allow that plant to get some good air circulation and reduce the amount of splash up that you have. That's really the basics of it. If you want to find more information, you can go to the website, thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com, and click on the tomato tab at the top of the page, and you can get some more in-depth, but we get you that'll get you started really early in the season.
Yeah.
And we'll come back to some more tomato-related topics later on in the season. If you've got a specific tomato topic question, you can always find the big red button on our website that says question, and submit that question to us, and we will answer it in an upcoming podcast during our question and answer session. And that's coming up right after the break and right after the return of Mike Novak with his environmental report. Right after this, we'll be right back.
At DollarSeed.com, all of our seeds are only $1 a pack. And we have online resources that teach you all about the rewarding hobby of growing your own plants, flowers, herbs, and vegetables. Imagine the joy you'll feel when your children actually help you harvest your first garden crop, or the pride of knowing you'll never need a florist again. Visit DollarSeed.com and grow a little magic of your own for just a dollar. DollarSeed.com. What could be healthier?
Water is our most important resource. The key is to capture the rain that falls on your property. No need for bulky rain barrels that are hard to handle and just don't fit in. Rain Reserve has solved the problem for you. With their multi-sized and color cube-like units, a rain barrel that does not look like one. Capturing rain easy, going unnoticed by passerbyers, and blending into the surrounding. Construction so easy, even children can put it together. To get your Rain Reserve, visit rainreserve.com. And use coupon code RAIN2016 to save 10% on total purchase.
What you feed your plants and soil matters. Tomatoes should be big and juicy, but not at the soil's expense. Age-old growth, bloom, kelp, and fish and seaweed. Reliable fertilizers gardens by supplying the plants and the soil with fast-acting nutrients and natural ingredients to create delicious plants and healthy soil. If you desire juicy tomatoes and healthy soil to grow them in, visit ageold.com for more information on Ageold and our suppliers.
Now back to two gardeners that know a little bit about what burns in their mouth.
And you don't want to use your, you know, organic mouthwash. You want to use something that's got the ethanol, the alcohol in it.
The bad stuff.
Yeah. The stuff that'll burn if you leave it in your mouth for too long.
Joey and Holly Baird.
Welcome back to the program. If you want to check out our sponsors, you can visit them on our website, WisconsinVegetableGardener.com. You just click on the podcast tab and you can see them there. Support them because they support us.
Well, we are happy to have Mr. Mike Novak from Q4 Radio in Chicago back with us. He had some things that he had to go through, some surgery. He's doing very well, and he is back on the program today, and he's going to talk all about LEDs and light pollution. And here is Mike Novak.
And now to a man who's not afraid to tell you what you need to do to keep the planet he lives on clean.
Take your food scraps out to your compost pile. Screw in a compact fluorescent light bulb. Turn on a window fan instead of an air conditioner. Low flow, baby. Shower heads and toilets. Take one napkin at Starbucks instead of six.
Mike Novak.
Welcome to another installment of the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Environmental Report. I'm Mike Novak, and you can hear me live each Sunday morning from 9 to 11 a.m. Central Time on Q4 Radio, which streams at www.QUE4.org. The city of Chicago, Illinois, already the number one most light-polluted city in the world, is getting ready to replace nearly all of the city's street, alley, and park lights with LEDs over the next 4 years. The Chicago Sun-Times calls this an upgrade, writing, calling it one of the largest municipal lighting modernization programs in the country. Rahm Emanuel's office said the city will begin using LED lights, which last three times longer than the current high-pressure sodium lamps. City Hall says it will be able to finance the program with the money it expects to save on electricity. Here's the problem. They're doing the same thing in Phoenix with this kind of result. I don't want to live in a community that looks like a POW camp or state prison, said Cynthia Malicki, a North Phoenix resident who calls the white LED lights ugly and unearthly. Now, it's estimated that 3/4 of the people living on this planet have never seen a completely dark sky. That's just one of the reasons that the Chicago Astronomical Society has launched a petition to get the city to change its lighting responsibly. Yes, LEDs will save money, but cheap isn't always best, especially when you consider that light pollution can have detrimental effects on human health, including increased risk of cancers, metabolic disease, obesity, depression, sleep disorders, cognitive impairments, and other diseases, suppression of melatonin production, which helps induce sleep, boosts the immune system, and helps the functioning of the thyroid, pancreas, ovaries, testes, and adrenal glands. There are unintended effects on wildlife and ecosystems, too. Nocturnal animals get confused about night when excessive man-made light trespasses their space, which affects their nocturnal activity, interfering with reproduction and reducing populations. Light pollution affects firefly reproduction, as well as circadian disruption among the monarch butterfly, interfering with safe migration. According to the Fatal Light Awareness Program, the estimated number of migrating birds killed annually in collisions with buildings ranges from 100 million to 1 billion birds. Sea turtles hatch at night on the beach and are guided by moonlight to the horizon over the ocean surface. Man-made lights draw them away from the water and to their demise. This extends to plants, too. Artificial lighting at night can disrupt an organism's natural sense of day and night, including trees and plants, causing the flowering, budding, and fruiting rhythms of the species to trigger at times not normally regulated by their natural cycles. We're all concerned about crime and safety, right? But brighter does not necessarily mean safer. While outdoor lighting is intended to increase safety at night, too much lighting can have the opposite effect. Glare from bright lighting constricts our pupils, which makes it harder for our eyes to adjust to low light conditions. The Chicago Astronomical Society says that if Chicago's light swap is done correctly, by avoiding the bright white, blue-rich color spectrum, shielding street lamps so light only shines downward, and using timers, dimming, and smart grid technology, Chicago could once again have starlight. If done incorrectly, Chicago, which is already rated number one, as I said before, could become 5 times brighter than it already is. Now, please note, they say, that they're not advocating for no lights. They're advocating for lighting that is responsible and no brighter than necessary, with a maximum correlated color temperature of 3,000 Kelvin, and only pointing light on the ground where it is needed, never sideways or upwards, which can cause unnecessary sky glow. Wouldn't it be nice if our children and their children could have the opportunity to view the stars in the sky the way we and our parents did? We need to preserve that wonder of the universe to pass along to future generations before it's too late. That's it for today. I hope you catch the Mike Novak Show on Q4 Radio, QUE4.org, which you can always link to at my website, MikeNovak.net. Go green or go home.
So now it's time for your questions, our answers. If you don't like our answers, don't ask the question, I guess, the result of that. We're going to give you the information that we know from our experience, and we have looked up and done research on questions that we don't know the answer to, and got reliable sources for them. So we've got 3 questions from 3 people, and we're going to cover them right now. First question: when I go to the home, when I go to my local garden center and pick out starts, what do I need to look for? What do I need to avoid? Well, here's what you need to look for, and here's what you need to avoid.
So for one, you want to choose, obviously, the plants that look healthy. But you want to make sure, say you're looking at a tomato plant.
Or pepper plant.
Or pepper plant. You want to make sure that there's not any flowers on them.
Or fruit.
Or fruit. Or fruit, obviously, too. Now, I know the last time we had to buy peppers from the garden center, all of them had flowers on there. So I think I just bought the ones that had the least, and then we pinch the flowers.
You're right,
off.
You can pinch them off.
Yeah.
What is happening on that, and we see this, and we've all done this, we've all went to our local home and garden center, our big box store, and we see these tomato plants, we see these pepper plants, we see these eggplants that have fruit on them, and they're like 98% off, and they're begging you to buy them, but there's no point of it, because you're going to bring it home, and the reason why it's already put fruit on is for 2 reasons. One, the plant is root-bound, and it believes that this is as far in life as it's going to get, and nature has told it, or it has, you know, it knows, I've got to put fruit on to produce seeds to carry on the traits for the next generation of seeds. That's what's occurring. So whenever you see the fruit on these plants, they've been root-bound for a very long time, and if you bring it home and try to plant it, the plant's already stunted. Mm-hmm. You may get some life out of it, but you're going to baby it. It's not worth the effort, even if it's a nickel or a quarter. You're just hurting yourself by doing this. Now, like Holly said, if you have no other choice, if you're buying peppers and there's little flowers on all of them, go ahead and pinch the flowers off and bring them home. You can salvage them. Now, we've been at the garden center where we've seen tomatoes that are like a quarter of a plant, about 1.5 feet tall, and they had cherry tomatoes on them already.
Or they sell those container tomatoes that already have a trellis.
That are 20-some-odd dollars.
That
already are bearing fruit 2 months before you should ever think about planting tomatoes.
Right.
So that's what you want to look for. You want to look for healthy plants, plants without blooms or fruit on them. And if you're buying, like, let's say lettuce or if you're buying a six-pack of peppers or whatever, try to look for those six-packs that have seven or eight plants in them. At the time of planting, these nurseries, if they'll drop extra seeds in the slots, the cells, not just on accident. So you'll go and you'll look, and you've got a six-pack of peppers that actually have seven or eight peppers that are healthy. So you just bring them home, divide that cell apart, and you got an extra couple of plants. And broccoli, cauliflower, you get a lot of that as well. So that's one. That's the answer to that question. Second question is, when I make pickles, should I try to use fresh dill, or is dill seed okay, or is there one better than the other?
There's not necessarily one better than the other, but keep in mind that dried herbs are a little bit stronger because they're more, I don't want to say concentrated, but once they're dried, their scent and their benefits come out. I don't want to say benefits, but I don't know what the word I'm looking for.
Intensity.
Yeah, intensity. Thank you. They seem to get more intense. So if you want, you can use either or. The recipe will tell you. It'll say a quarter cup or something of fresh dill, and then or it'll say like a tablespoon of dill seed. So as you can tell right there,
I mean, if you have dill that's fresh that's in your garden, go ahead and use it.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
but sometimes the dill and the cucumbers don't cross or don't grow at the same rate, so you're gonna have to use sometimes the dry stuff or the seeds.
And if you don't grow dill, don't. I mean, you could grow it, but keep in mind it does seed and spread.
It is an invasive plant in some portions of the United States.
Yes.
We started it in containers, or in a container, 6 years ago in the front yard here at the WI Garden Media Studios, and it went to seed, and we have been fighting that ever since then for 6 years. And, 2 years ago we decided, hey, we're just going to see how many seeds we can get. Mm-hmm. I stopped collecting seeds when I got 2 half-gallon mason jars full of clean dill seed, and there was still dill plants out in the in the garden.
Now, one thing is it does attract a lot of butterflies and things to your garden because the caterpillars they like to hang on the stalks of it. But it's invasive. So you know, it's really up to you. If you have dill growing and you want to use it, go ahead. If you don't, then just use the dill seed. But just keep in mind that the seed is stronger.
Okay, another question, or last question for this week. At the end of the season, when you harvest your tomatoes, you know, the frost is coming, you pull them all off the vine, not all of them are ripe. And you usually harvest the green ones, you clean the whole vines off and mm-hmm. get what you can. How long can you keep green tomatoes at the end of the season?
Well, it depends on how long they're going to stay green.
And, well, what are you going to use them for?
Well, this happened to us. I don't
know. 4 years ago?
No, it was a little...
Oh, was it more than that?
2 years ago.
Okay.
And we had that frost that came. I pulled all the tomatoes off. I just kept them in by a window. And eventually they turned red. The skins were a little tough. But I think I made, like, soup with them. I made some salsa. And I just... Stuff that I didn't really need the skins for.
Now, here's the thing with the tomatoes. If you pull them off when they're solid, solid green, they will take a very long time to ripen.
Yes.
If you can pull them or leave them on the vine until there's at least some pigment change at the bottom of the tomato fruit, tomatoes ripen from the bottom up and around to the top. If you can harvest, wait till they at least get some pigment change on the bottom, they will ripen quicker. You can also put them in a paper sack. Mm-hmm. Is it with a banana?
Yeah.
And that will help them ripen quicker as well. But a solid green tomato will take a very long time to ripen off the vine versus a tomato that you've picked off the vine that at least has some color change at the bottom of the fruit. So keep that in mind. You can put them in your windowsill as well, and they'll ripen, but they will ripen slower.
Mm-hmm.
So with that being said, if you've got a question... We will find an answer for you. You can submit that by going to the WisconsinVegetableGardener.com and clicking on the red button on the right-hand side that says Question. And submit your question there, and we will answer it through email as well as address it here on the program for the rest of the world to hear your question and the answer so we all can be more educated. Coming up next, the producer of Central Texas Gardener,
Linda Lumens-Burdum.
She will be talking not only about gardening in Texas, but about other related topics that affect all of us nationwide right after this.
Do you want your next raised beds to be easy, functional, and beautiful? The Embrace helps you create the garden you've always wanted. Finally, raised beds that everyone can assemble and enjoy. No tools needed. Just slide any lumber into the Embrace corner, fill with your favorite soil mix, and you're ready to plant. Made from 100% recycled steel right here in the USA. And a portion of every sale helps to build school and community gardens all across the country. Let the Embrace help you create your next raised bed. Grow beautifully with the Embrace. Available at local garden centers and online at artofthegarden.net.
Looking for a fast-acting, non-toxic weed killer for your organic garden? One that works in cool and cloudy conditions as low as 40 degrees and is highly biodegradable with visible results in less than 2 hours? Then look no more. Avenger Weed Killer has it all and more. Made from oranges, Avenger is highly effective, easy to use, and has a pleasant citrus aroma. It is OMRI listed and approved for organic gardeners under the USDA's National Organic Program. Avenger Weed Killer is a choice for organic gardeners and homeowners who are looking for an effective, safe way to control unwanted weeds. Available in ready-to-use sprays and concentrate, ask your local lawn and garden supplier for Avenger Weed Killer. For more information and a list of suppliers, visit AvengerOrganics.com. Avenger Weed Killer, eco-friendly, deadly to weeds.
It's all about the soil at ManureT.com. With their grass-fed, antibiotic, and growth hormone-free cattle and horses, owner Annie Haven puts the quality in her premium soil conditioner. 100% organic and natural, whether feeding your flowers or veggies, indoors or out, you can grow organically with confidence. To purchase authentic Haven brand manure tea, small orders or large, go to ManureT.com. Always free shipping!
Hi, I'm Douglas E. Welch from A Gardener's Notebook at DouglasEWelch.com. Whether I'm out working in the garden or dreaming of gardening during the long, cold winter nights, I love to hear what's happening in the garden with Joey and Holly Baird on the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Podcast.
Welcome back to the program. If you want to know more about the sponsors you've just heard and our entire sponsor lineup, you can check them out on our website, thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com, as well as those links are in the show notes below. Well, Holly, let's go to the TWVG hotline and bring in our next guest.
Our guest, she is the producer of the Central Texas Gardener. Her name is Linda Lumens-Burdum, and she's all about organic gardening, outstanding water-wise plants, design inspiration, wildlife control, homegrown food, and creative fun in the garden. They won the 2010 Lone Star Emmy, Garden Writers of America Electron Media Award. You can see Central Texas Gardener on KLRU-TV, Austin's PBS station, or watch online at klru.org/CTG. What's a gardener to do when heat, pests, water restrictions, and bad soil? We are going to talk about all that and more, but first, welcome to the program, Linda.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. My grandparents lived, and my father lived, grew up in Wisconsin for many years, so it's really fun to connect back to the hometown, so to speak.
Well, you know, we bring you on as a producer of Central Texas Gardening, and people are like, well, what is a person in Texas have to do with the, you know, Wisconsin stuff? Well, as we talked about, Holly said that, you know, we can watch this online, and you have gardeners from all over be guests on the program. I know Shauna Coronado, she's from Chicago, she was on the program. Dee Nash, she's from Oklahoma, she was on the program, because gardening is an umbrella, and everything under that umbrella is information that we can pick and choose and modify for our particular growing area. And that, I think that's wonderful that we have that technology to use.
Indeed, and in fact, we've been delighted to meet with Sharon Lovejoy and Doug Tallamy and Richard Louv and so many other fine gardeners. But the way that we reach out to everyone, and the reason we have an intense following across the board, national on PBS, online, as you mentioned, and of course in social media, is that a lot of the tips and the information and the botany apply everywhere. Also, we concentrate on design concepts by hands-on backyard gardeners on how they created their own little sense of beauty themselves by placing this here and that there and the problems they faced and how they got past it. And that's a universal sensitivity. Everyone wants to know how someone else did it. How they turned a blank yard into beauty. And then also, we feature stories from all different kinds of gardeners, from vegetable gardeners to succulent lovers to rose lovers, family gardening, whatever. And so there's kind of something for everyone. And then the plants, you just adjust per your climate zone. Here in Texas, we have so many zones. In fact, in just a few hundred miles, the zones change so much. So you have to adapt no matter of where you are.
So let's talk about a universal problem that all gardeners face, no matter where they're at in the country, is drought. Texas is known for some of the hottest days in the United States, and my grandfather has always said, no matter where you're at in the summer, you're about 10 days away from a drought. So what are some heat-tolerant plants, whether vegetable or landscape plants, that we can incorporate into our property that we can limit how much water we give them, but they still will retain the beauty as well as the productivity if they're an edible plant?
Well, here in Central Texas and many other places, it's not just a question of drought. As several people have coined, we've been experiencing years of drought supplemented by flooding, which is the big thing that we face here. So we have heat and drought. But then we also get unseasonable cold, 14 degrees, which is not usual. We can also get flooding rain, 7 to 11 inches or even 3 inches in an hour. So for the people who just went for, say, all the succulents a few years ago when everyone panicked, they lost many of those plants in drought, I mean in flooding. And so we have to kind of modify it and pay attention. It's not so much just what you plant for drought, but how you do it. So say here, if we're going to plant succulents and you don't have the perfectly drained spot, you build it up with decomposed granite and other materials, not too much organic material. And then we also use rain gardens. So to help keep some of the runoff from the street, you can dig just small little areas and plant rain gardens. And there's so many plants you can use in rain gardens. Salvias, grasses, sedges. The list goes on and on for things that you can plant that can withstand drought and then rain bombs. Then for heat and drought-tolerant plants, here in Texas, for the people who like okra in the summer, okra is the winner. It'll make it all summer long. That's kind of the top one. You know, the tomatoes here, they do need some water, but there are ways to conserve water when planting vegetables. And then for us, the heat, drought-tolerant plants definitely include woody salvias, native trees. As long as you water them the first year, every plant, whether it's native or adapted, needs to be well watered at least the first year and for many years after, especially with the trees. We've lost countless trees in the past few years due to drought. People think, oh, it's a native plant, it's a native tree, it's a native shrub. Well, I'll water it today, I put it in, and then that's it. Goodbye, you know, it's a native plant. That is not true. They need a period of establishment. And so the other thing on picking plants for drought, you have to look at your soil, your site, because here where I live, I'm on very clay-heavy soil. If I plant a drought, heat-loving plant like Florida of Daisy, it will rot in the humidity and any sort of heavy rain, whereas on the other side of the highway in rocks, it will be fine. Then over here, we can plant pecan trees, which are not native, but They are native. And they are very drought tolerant if you give them some water. But in a rockier climate, they're not going to be able to establish themselves. So I go for salvias. I go for a lot of the native plants. I go for grasses and sedges. I mix in a lot of things. One thing people think is you have to have all natives, and I have a lot of natives, but I also have plants like irises that I can remember all the people who have passed those along to me over the years. Those guys are bulletproof when it comes to drought. They add beautiful foliar texture. In the spring, the late spring, so many pollinators love the flowers, and they're very, very drought tolerant. So the other thing is I like to make sure that a plant, any plant in my yard that's going to receive supplemental water, has some purpose for wildlife, because that's critical. In times of drought, they need nourishment. Well, they need nourishment all the time, but especially during times of drought, to make sure that you've got flowers, seeds, something always going on to provide food for them. And then another thing, when thinking about drought, some people say, well, these plants are really drought tough, but are they invasive? Years ago, the xeriscape type of groups would recommend even things like Nandina, because it is so tough. It tolerates drought, flooding, it tolerates anything, but it's highly invasive, and it's totally ruining our waterways and taking over our creek banks and wiping out the homogeneous variety of native plants. So with drought plants, I would say look at what grows in nature. Look what grows on the strips in the highway, aside from the invasive or the weeds, but there are a lot of native plants out there. And select the one that fit your site.
So, I mean, a lot of great information, because yeah. People instantly go, well, I'm going to put this in there, and because the person at the nursery recommended it, well, that guy at the nursery, that woman at the nursery is trying to sell you something, whether you may or may not want it, because they can make money off of you. Knowing what's going to be beneficial and is not going to take over your property, important information that, you know, we all need to be aware of.
Now, most all gardeners...
The other thing is, at nurseries, I buy from local nurseries who get their plants from local growers. That is critical. And then you also have to look at, be very careful with those tags and the amount of sunlight, especially if you are not buying from your local grower. In Wisconsin, something that can take full sun would die in a heartbeat in Texas summer. And so that's another thing. When you go to the nursery, pay attention, do your homework. Where did this plant come from? You know, it could be a plant from Wisconsin that's going to do beautifully here. For example, my grandparents grew chrysanthemums. And by golly, those things are drought tough here. I've had some for years that handle everything. In fact, one of the gardeners we visited with a few years ago moved from Minnesota. She and her husband transplanted to Texas, and she was just, oh, my gosh, what am I going to do now? She was in rot, solid rot, hot Texas sun. But she wanted some of the favorites from her Wisconsin, her Minnesota home. And she tried chrysanthemums, and by golly, they just have worked great. The other thing I have to say about drought and plants is we hear about this from all over the country, not just from what I see in Central Texas. We hear about it from everywhere. People overreacted. They pulled out every piece of living material and graveled it. Well, that is hot. And aside from it's going to attract weeds, there's no benefit for wildlife. It's hot. It's ugly. There's nothing for wildlife. And if we don't have plants to support our wildlife, where are we going to be? We're not going to have the birds or the butterflies. We're not going to have the toads. We're not going to have the lizards. So we really have to think, I think, in a bigger picture than just drought tolerant or xeric. It needs to have a bigger picture. Is this plant right for my situation? Is it going to provide wildlife benefit without needing pesticides or anything? How much water can it get by on if it's mulched properly? If I water it to get it established and then keep it composted, keep it mulched, And so that will retain the water that's there. The other thing you can do, and I'm doing some of this in my own yard a little bit at a time, is to create berms and swales. Watch where that rainfall hits and create little berms and swales so that it captures it and directs it. When I plant a new plant, I dig a little swale around it so that it will capture any rainfall that comes in. And, of course, it eventually fills in. But every now and then I'll go through, especially in places where I know water's kind of hitting more, and create little swales around and kind of move it around and then mulch over that or create little berms to capture it. Then once again on those berms, you can plant some of the plants that require absolute great drainage.
Great. Now, most every gardener grows tomatoes, even if they don't grow a huge vegetable garden. What are some great tomato growing tips?
Great tomato growing tips. Well, you know, everybody has kind of their favorite thing. Put four gardeners together and you're going to get 15 opinions. But essentially from what I've heard and from my own experience, but from people who really know what they're talking about with tomatoes, compost. That's it, compost. One guy I know relies on mushroom compost because it's close. The mushroom factory is close to where he lives. But wherever, compost, compost, compost. They also need nitrogen. Some people don't even use any fertilizer. They simply use compost, or they'll add cottonseed meal to boost the nitrogen a bit. You can. Some people will dig, you know, when they dig the hole, they'll put a little phosphorus in. Other people don't do that. They just rely on cottonseed meal, compost, side dressing, or, you know, foliar spraying with fish emulsion or side dressing with a high nitrogen kind of fertilizer as the growing season goes along. And for us, I don't know if this is common everywhere, but for us, one of the techniques is to build kind of a little trench or dig a little trench, and you lay the stem kind of horizontally in there and cover that up. And that also helps in areas with high wind. And then, of course, the cutworm thing. You've got to protect them from cutworms. Here, our biggest problem, and this is very recent, actually, are the four-footed bugs, the largest bugs, stink bugs. They just can overwhelm a population. And so the secret to them is to get out early in the morning when they're all kind of drowsy, and it's cool, and you handpick them. Some people have a dedicated little, like a dustbuster kind of thing to scoop them up in. One person even went to the trouble of a shop vac, I think, to kind of scoop those up. And then for us, and perhaps for everyone else too, is to keep the moisture as even as possible so that you don't get blossom end rot or splitting. You know, tomatoes, of course, there's not much you can do if you get 11 inches of rain in 2 hours. But within, whatever you can control to keep kind of an even moisture on them.
Right. And let's talk about controlling something that we may be able to control. Is that is wildlife that wants to eat our vegetables that we've worked very hard to do. Some people will recommend using firearms. That's not always the answer, or legal in most places. What are some tips that you have found that gardeners have used that were relatively successful for keeping out large animals as well as small animals from their garden?
Relatively is an excellent term there. That is probably the most frustrating thing for gardeners here, as it is for everywhere. Here, you work so hard to cultivate your pears and peaches and your tomatoes and your peppers, and here comes something through there and just chomps them all to pieces. You know, this is not the easy answer. I've heard every single trick in the book. Netting, using Christmas balls early in the season, scarecrow things, you know, the whirligig kinds, everything under the face of the sun. And the only thing that I've seen that works against deer and little animals crawling, burrowing, chewing, animals, flying animals, is the cage them. I mean, just build an absolute cage around it. That's going to be the way to do it. Or you can just grow a whole lot more. You know, people often say just, you know, grow some extra for the wildlife. I've also known some people at a community garden here can say that this worked positively, but they had some results with it. Yeah, they were really having a problem with the birds on their tomatoes, as you can imagine. It was hot, it was dry, the birds were thirsty. So what they did is kind of build up a little, a little ledge, I guess. And on it, they placed a series of pot saucers, plant pot saucers with water, which they filled every day. Then next to that, they planted those huge, gigantic sunflowers in the hope that the birds would get distracted with the sunflowers and they get water from the bowls and maybe that would fend them off. Some people, you know, will go to the trouble of putting an entire net over a fruit tree and anchoring it down. But, you know, how much work do you really want to go through? Oh, but I will say one other simple trick, which has worked for one gardener I met, is he grows habanero peppers. And then when he dries them, he grinds them into a fine powder. Of course, you can go buy your own habanero or hot pepper, you know, any place. But he likes to do it himself, and he makes these great sauces for his friends and everything. Anyway, he sprinkles the around his beds, and no squirrel will even come near them. And that's saved him a lot of trauma. As for the birds, they're still going to get to him, but he conquered the squirrels with habanero powder. But, you know, you put it in your, you accidentally get a little bit in your eye, and you're going to wish you didn't do it.
Well, Linda, we greatly appreciate you taking time out of your day to join us on the program. For people who are not in the Austin, Texas area, what's the best place, again, for them to see Central Texas gardening, or gardener on their computer?
Well, we've got several. You can go online to your PBS station, and in the online box, hit Central Texas Gardener, and all our episodes are there. They never expire. The fastest way, perhaps, would be to go to klru.org/CTG, and we have tons of resources. We have plant lists. We have questions from our viewers that apply to everyone across the country. We have books. We have videos of our gardens, our backyard basics, our interviews. Everything is right there at klru.org/CTG. You can also find us on Facebook, Central Texas Gardener, on Instagram and Pinterest, and on Twitter.
And I will have both of those links. We'll have all those links in the show notes below, and I encourage our listeners to go check that out. You will spend an afternoon learning stuff that you never knew, and you still will have a lot more information on the website to go through. Linda, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's great to have this conversation with you.
And we'll be back right after this.
If you could double the life of your raised bed boxes by sealing the wood with a non-toxic wood preservative, would you? Well, now you can with a clear, penetrating product called Internal Wood Stabilizer. It's 100% non-toxic and easy to apply. Seal your bare, untreated wood surfaces, even chicken coops, by spraying Internal Wood Stabilizer. It's invisible, seals the wood from the inside out, and never wears off. Recommended by organic gardening experts, Internal Wood Stabilizer. Check it out at timberprocoatings.com.
A gardener knows that the key to a good plant is its roots. With poor roots, the end result is not good. Conventional pots and trays cause roots to wrap around and become root bound. Then you try to unwrap the roots at the time of planting, hoping not to break them. But never again with the Root Maker, a non-chemical innovation that naturally air prunes roots to create more vigorous roots. Never a root bound plant again. Whether trees, flowers, or edibles, home gardener, commercial grower, more roots means healthier, more productive plants. To get your own, visit rootmaker.com.
Oh, yeah. What you say? You say Nasala kombucha. It'll put some glide in your stride and some pep in your step. Nasala kombucha. Yeah.
Nasala kombucha makes your body happy. Nasala kombucha makes your body smile.
Hello, this is Sean James Cameron from the Horticultural Channel based in London, England, giving you practical gardening advice for the amateur gardener. Check us out at thehortchannel.tv. But right now we're going to join Joey and Holly Baird on the Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Podcast.
Welcome back to the program. If you'd like to check out those sponsors and our entire sponsor lineup, you can find that information on our website, thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com. Underneath the podcast tab, you'll see their links to their websites, as well as all of the podcasts that we have done to date, and the guests and the topics that we have covered. And we've covered a lot of topics, and Linda covered a lot of topics as well. Being here from Wisconsin and learning about stuff that grows in Texas that I've never heard of before, because of the tremendous difference in climate. But it's gardening is a universal topic, as we talked with Linda about. That, you know, it's not just Texas, it's not just Wisconsin, it's everywhere. And we just got to tweak some of the dates and times that we apply the information that we gather in our own particular growing area. So
Gardening in 2 Minutes.
Yep.
Gardening in 2 Minutes is a production that we produce. It's a two-minute production. It goes out weekly to several gardening podcasts and radio shows. And that's what it is. It's just a two-minute quick gardening tip.
This week's Gardening in 2 Minutes is all about...
It's all about no-touch bug control, or hands-free bug control.
And here is Gardening in 2 Minutes. This is Gardening in 2 Minutes. As gardeners, we all face, no matter the size of our garden, problems with bugs. Now, there's a couple of answers to what do I do because I have this bug problem. We'll go over a simple no-touch bug control that may work for you in your particular garden.
Sometimes when you have a grouping of plants, say you have 3 zucchini plants and only one has bugs on it, well, you can do something. You could yank that plant out, but then if the bugs are still there, they're going to go to the other 2 plants. So what can you do, Joey?
Well, you can use that plant as a sacrificial lamb. Allow the bad bugs to get on that plant, lay the eggs, eat that plant up, and allow the other plants around it to not be effective. Now, this does happen, but now if there are bugs on all of your plants, then yes, and then there's an opportunity for you to purchase a chemical or a homemade remedy to remove or control those bad bugs. But if it's on one centralized plant, leave that plant in the ground. Keep an eye on it, but leave that plant in the ground so all those bad bugs will go to that plant and not affect the other plants. But if there are bugs on other plants, then you're going to have to look at a way of controlling.
Be proactive and control the bugs. But if, like Joey said, just leave the one and just keep an eye on it.
Now, if you do buy a chemical, that chemical will kill all of your bugs in their garden, good and bad. So you want to look at ways to control the bad insects by introducing good bugs into your garden, or homemade remedies that will reduce the number of bad bugs and will harm fewer good bugs. So when you have a bug problem, just don't go to your local home and garden center and purchase the first chemical you see, because that may not be the answer for what you need it for. For more information on controlling bugs in your garden, our weekly video productions, as well as our free downloadable digital quarterly magazine, you can find all that information at
thewisconsinvegetablegardener.com.
For Gardening in 2 Minutes, I'm Joy Baird.
I'm Holly Baird.
So if you've got some bugs, you might want to go with that approach. Don't touch it. Maybe just kind of let nature take its course. Well, we are out of time this week on the program. We greatly appreciate you tuning in. We've had a lot of information about tomatoes. If you want to know more about tomatoes, again, that tab on the website, under the tomatoes tab, it'll tell you how many... We grow in 26 varieties. It'll tell you what we grow, as well as some more in-depth information in regards to planting, maintaining, and harvesting, which we'll get into that maintaining and harvesting portion of it later on in the season as we get to that portion as well. And most of the northern portions of the United States has already are getting to it. Southern portion of the United States, I know Texas is at this point already harvesting tomatoes because they plant them in February and they grow them till about mid-June, July before the temperatures spike and then they try to get another harvest. This is central southern Texas and they try to get another double crop in each year, which that would be kind of neat, but it'd be better to be able to grow tomatoes year-round like on the whole island of Hawaii or a warm climate where it doesn't freeze. So with that being said, the audio that you've heard is courtesy of sfx.co.uk, an audio free, and audioneutronics.com, audio copyright free and royalty free websites that we use to help liven up the podcast.
And then we also have audio from Nestle and Dollar Seed, and they provide that on their own.
So until next time, I'm Joy Baird.
I'm Holly Baird.
Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you in the garden.
The Wisconsin Vegetable Gardener Podcast is a production of the WisconsinVegetableGardener.com for the health-conscious organic gardener worldwide and distributed in association with WI Garden Media.